Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on the podcast today, it's PMQs Unpacked. A brand new episode, none of the classic episodes we've brought you over the last few weeks. PMQs returns, Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer going at it. Tim Shipman joined me to pause the action live from the House of Commons to analyse the key exchanges in real time in Lower Spirit, rounding up the best of the rest. Before that, in The Columnist, Robert Crampton and Alice Thompson on whether there are just glimmers of hope for Rishi Sunak. Some things started to go the right direction for him. But is it all too little too late? And if you like what you hear on the podcast, join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. It's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. Now, I don't want to go on about her again and again today because, you know, she's got some fan. But two final nuggets from Liz Truss Day yesterday that I wanted to share with you. There was this magnificent exchange in the House of Lords from Lord Grocott asking David Cameron a question.
Has the Foreign Secretary had time to reflect on the comments of Liz Truss, who said that she would like to see the United Nations abolished because she claimed she doesn't see a purpose for the organisation? So has he got any message to those of us who can't see a purpose of Liz Truss?
I take the view that the United Nations has many problems and issues, and the frustrations of dealing with the Security Council at the moment, when you've got a Russian veto and a Chinese veto, these frustrations are very great. But nonetheless, it's important we have an international body where issues can be discussed, where countries can come together. Good work is done through the United Nations in spite of the frustrations. So I can see the point of the United Nations.
And Liz Truss, he didn't quite answer the question. And then in the Commons last night, as MPs were debating the smoking ban, Liz Truss's moaning that everyone is against her reached a new low.
They talked about ferrets so much that I was not even able to speak.
Sorry, what?
They talked about ferrets so much that I was not even able to speak.
Right, that's enough. It's enough. It's enough.
They talked about ferrets so much that I was not even able to speak.
Look, if you're online buying a book, buy a copy of Planes, Trains and Toilet Doors while you're there as well.
The Columnists with Ali Burt, Alice Thompson and Robert Crampton.
And they're both here in blue today. Yep. It coordinated again.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
You've got a sort of blue gingham.
Gingham, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Gingham, yeah.
And
blue
stripes.
Yeah, lovely.
Yeah. We do match each other the whole time.
Just to paint a picture.
Mm. Yeah. But you haven't got your jacket on.
No, I've not got a jacket. I've got a proper jacket on.
Yeah, very smart.
Well, it's a relaxed jacket.
Yeah.
I'm feeling really hounded by Rishi Sunak because he's now got the mug that I have. Did you see that mug with dogs on it?
No.
Yeah, he's now
got your trainers.
Yeah, I've got my trainers, my mug. I'm now feeling really embarrassed that I'm like too like Rishi Sunak.
Or maybe he's modelling himself on
you.
Yeah,
he's copying.
He could be. I could be sending him notes in the morning, couldn't I?
Yeah. Well, it's working for him.
Yeah, this, what a revival.
What a revival. It's all happening. So, this is what I wanted to sort of talk about. So, there's a whole sort of load of little threads today.
Yeah.
So, this could be quite a good week for Rishi Sunak.
Mm-hmm.
So, he's got his smoking thing through last night. Mm-hmm. Albeit with a lot of rebellion, but it's going to happen.
165 Tories didn't vote for it.
Which isn't brilliant. There's almost as many who did vote for it. Mm-hmm. But David Cameron got gay marriage through with massive Tory rebellions, and now it's one of the great things that David Cameron did. Ooh. So, you know, fine. But it's the thing he wants to do, and it's going to happen. Tick. The Rwanda bill's going to pass tonight. He's been trying to get that for ages. That's going to end up on the statute book. Inflation's coming down. It's been talked about that for ages. It's down to 3.2%. That's quite good. Meanwhile, the Labour Party can't do anything without talking about Angela Rayner's all over the front pages again today.
And what are the polls saying? Is it still 20 points?
Still 20 points.
Yeah.
Is it just too little too late?
I think it's actually... I mean, it is a good week for him, but if he's only ever going to be known for Rwanda and smoking, that is never going to be enough for him. He's not... You know, that's not going to pull it out of the bag. And I also think that he's... You know, his own party don't really want him anymore. They're, you know, it's not just they're rebelling against him. They just think he's slightly ludicrous and he's petulant and it still feels, you know, too little too late. And, you know, I think the Angela Rayner issue is difficult for Labour, but nothing like what the Tories have got to get through now.
And there are clearly questions to be asked about the Angela Rayner thing because the police are asking them.
Mm-hmm.
But the Tories going quite so overboard in thinking that this is going to in some way reinstall Rishi Sunak in Downing Street is just nonsense, isn't it?
I don't think it's got that sort of level of cut through. I think it's making people maybe a bit sceptical about people who liked Angela Rayner are thinking, oh, well, did Angela Rayner not pay her taxes? And people don't like that. And she'll be one of the people responsible for spending other people's taxes in a few months' time. But she still will be in that position. It's not going to be anybody else. It's not going to be... So it's not going to presage a Tory revival. No.
I feel she's slightly differently. I think that you've got 12 police officers all engaged in Angela Rayner, and I prefer them to be looking at crime. And I think quite a lot of voters will feel like
exactly
that too.
Exactly that topic.
Yeah, I mean, Matthew Paris was very strong on this this morning in his notebook, saying, I must admit, I kind of saw where he was coming from. It doesn't seem like.
Well, you can see if you're desperate why you would go after her. And actually, in a way, it's good politics because it's a local election. They've closed down any time any Labour politician now goes on the air. Yeah. They have to answer the Angela Rayner question.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I think there are quite a lot of voters who are being put off by this because they feel that you've got one party that has got quite a lot of sort of non-doms involved, that's got quite a lot of money that's come from all sorts of ways of clever tax accounting. And then they're going after someone who at the most probably, you know, could have misspent 1,500 quid that she should have given back, 2,000 quid. Clever accounting, that could get down to zero on her capital gains tax. So it's complicated because actually I think some people will think, why are you hounding her?
And it also goes back to motivation, doesn't it? I mean, being charitable, bluntly, she probably just didn't know what she was doing. The idea that she was, you know, given her explanations of her, let's be honest, quite chaotic private life.
I'm not sure that's the case because she took advice.
Oh, okay, that is true. So,
she's followed the advice.
Yeah.
But we know what accountants are there for. They're there to minimise your exposure to the revenue. Yeah. So the advice could well be, this is what you do if you don't want to. And she went, oh, thank you very much. I'll take your advice.
That's what she should be doing.
I mean, it's difficult. There is a principle involved. You should say, well, the amount of money isn't relevant. It's a small amount. But in terms of its electoral impact, which is what you're asking, I don't think it will really have one.
So what about then?
So yes, I think it's too little too late.
But then on all the other positives, because he just... I mean,
the governments are supposed to pass legislation,
aren't
they?
In fact, they're passing so little legislation that I think it's rather ridiculous that actually all you've got is the smoking, which, I mean, I totally agree with actually on the smoking, but I still think that it's not a particularly big issue. I think it's something that I wouldn't want to be known for. I think gay marriage was a bigger issue, to be honest. I think actually the lottery was a bigger issue for John Major. I think to have that as one of yours, and then Rwanda is just one word that is going to sum up this Prime Minister, isn't it? And I think that's not the word I would want as my legacy.
I think the smoking... I think smoking is a battle won. I think it's 13-14% of British adults smoke now. Still, there's one in seven, one in eight, one in seven, one in seven and a half. I think there's, it's bad, but it's it's a battle won, I think, largely won. And there's other more serious things. I mean, I think we'd be looking at obesity rather than smoking, to be honest.
Well, as a smoker, do you feel persecuted?
No.
No.
No, I don't. I think that's, yeah, it's my choice. It's kind of, would I do it again? No. Would I want my children to do it? No. Does the state have a duty to look after the health of its citizens? Yes.
Yeah.
I think you have to do it, though, in combination with vaping, because otherwise, if you just say you can't smoke and they all take up vaping, we're trying to do that too, but I think we have to be really cut down on it and on food. I mean, I do think Robert's right that the big issue now is obesity. And I think that's the biggest problem. We're not doing anything with the companies now who are pushing these, you know, not just fast food, but, you know, really trans fat sort of... a lot of it is absolutely disgusting. And I think they've got away with that for way too long.
We've got something like two-thirds of British adults are either overweight or obese now.
Yeah.
It's serious. I mean, I think it's a bigger problem than the fact that one in seven of them still smoke.
And actually, there's a slight, I would say, suspicion that they're happier doing something on smoking because people like us don't smoke.
Yeah.
Present company accepted. In the political class.
Perfectly true.
In the political class.
Yeah, I'm actually the only person.
Whereas everybody likes their, you know, whether it's Aldi or Waitrose, you know,
it's numbers.
Changing what you eat
is,
well, that's got to affect all of us, not those people over there. It's interesting. So if things aren't going well for us.
But your other one, inflation, is obviously good news.
Yeah.
But then it doesn't.
It's not as good as it was meant to be.
It means it's still going. People forget that it means prices are still going up.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean they're going down. It means they're going up.
And they did such a massive job on telling us that it going up was nothing to do with them.
Yes.
It's all down to Ukraine and that nasty Vladimir Putin and the energy prices and all of that.
Also,
it's interest rates going down, isn't it? I mean, that's the other problem, is that they're not coming down yet, the interest rates. Yeah. People aren't going to see that in their mortgages. They aren't going to see that, you know, in their daily lives. It's going to be quite hard, I think, to notice the inflation.
And it's not going to be an inevitable, inexorable decline, because if there's a war with Iran, and the kind of practice already is, then oil prices are going to go back up again.
Yeah.
Significantly, so...
So then, put all that together. maybe it is a good news for him. Will he last? This is the question for Rishi Sunak. Will he... stay the course, even. So on How to Win an Election yesterday, we were talking about this, and I asked Danny Finkelstein, if there were a bad set of local election results, would he stay? If he's challenged, will he stay and fight?
A small possibility is that he might not, if there was an attempt to remove him from office, he might just go. I don't think that's absolutely impossible. I think it's not what I expect to happen, but not absolutely impossible.
It's quite interesting, isn't it?
Danny's quite close to number 10, so I think if he feels that, he's described before that, you know, I think Rishi Sunak can be quite petulant, and you can see that it's always gone his way. He's been head boy, he's got very good results, he's gone to Oxford, you know, he's gone to, you know, McKinsey's, he's done all the sort of big jobs, he's never really failed at anything, and I think now... He is feeling, you know, actually slightly put upon, and I'm trying my hardest and you don't really understand me. And I think that comes across very much. So I could just see him giving up, actually.
I think Danny was the first person to talent spot Rishi when he was, before he was in the Commons, I think, when he was going for a Hague seat. And so Danny knows what he's talking about. And I mean, I don't know about internal Conservative politics. I just know that they seem to have gone barking mad.
Yeah.
So the idea that they could get bad results and there could be a challenge, I mean,
but you can't have another Prime Minister without him being elected being elected, can you?
You shouldn't, but you can. Anything you can constitutionally.
There's quite a lot. It starts with a sentence. You can't have. Yeah, and then it happens. 2 years, which I think that happening. Anyway, it was an interesting thought, question posited by Danny, who has been right about other things before. So we'll see what happens there. Let's talk about other slightly tricky political characters.
Oh, yeah.
Robert, you went and interviewed the new Welsh First Minister, Vaughan Gething.
I did, and I didn't have a lot to write about, and... that's often the case when you've done an interview, and I don't think Vaughan Gething is a bad man. I quite liked him, and he's got a very interesting backstory. He's a mixed race. His dad's a white Welsh vet who went to work in Zambia, where he met his mum, and they came back to this country, and Vaughan and his brothers and his sister had all sorts of issues with racism, which he described, and that was all the interesting part of the interview. But you're looking for things to bond in an interview, you know, we all know this, and I had a few in my locker, in that I go to Pembrokeshire on holiday. The area where we were, Tiger Bay, I'd been there right at the beginning of its development when I was shadowing Blair 20 years ago. My dad was a Labour member of the European Parliament, so I've got us on that right side of that. My parents worked in Uganda as teachers, rather like his dad went to Zambia as a vet. And I've got four mixed-race cousins who had experience of being mixed-race in this country. And every one of those, I thought, is a kind of potential bonding. You know, you play these cards, don't you, when you're trying to bond with somebody quickly. And the guy just didn't want to know. He was sort of politely nodded and went, hmm. And
I have to say,
he didn't want to be friends, basically. And he was doing an interview. He didn't want to have a conversation,
yeah.
You know. And that's fair enough. But it gave me, encounters can be awkward and you don't necessarily want to introduce yourself into them. But I had to think of something that would keep the reader's interest, because there wasn't a lot else.
Well, I have to say the most interesting thing about the whole piece was your life.
Right.
Your biography was more interesting than anything that I really got from him.
Right.
Which isn't necessarily what you...
No, it's definitely not what you want to do. But you also... You're
but it's sort of illustrative.
You want to inform and entertain the readers. Yeah, that's what you're thinking. And with what I had, the conventional stuff I had from him, other than the race backstory, which was interesting, wasn't really.
Yeah.
But the problem is, quite often, the most sort of sensible, straightforward politicians make the worst interviews. So if you interview Theresa May, she's really very dull. And if you interview Keir Starmer, you have to really talk about his childhood to get a lot out of him. But if you interview Liz Truss, she's actually incredibly entertaining and amusing and rushing around and slightly bonkers. And so that's the problem. So as an interviewer, you rather like the slightly mad, insane, late...
Yes, and people who are sort of sensible.
Chaotic person.
I remember interviewing Mike Atherton when he was England cricket captain, and I know Mike Atherton now, he's a colleague, and he's a lovely man, but as an interviewee, he was hopeless, because he is a lovely man, he didn't want to... He had no designs to be famous or quotable or to be there with a journalist.
I think actually someone like George Osborne is quite a good politician in a way, because he knows how to do an interview. He'll give you one or two things. Whereas David Cameron never was. He was also quite petulant about being interviewed and didn't really want to be.
Yeah.
And I did an Airbnb Campbell yesterday.
Although he famously called you and Rachel the evil twins?
No, someone did call us the killer bimbos. That was bad, actually.
Well, that is bad.
That was pretty bad, because I thought that was...
But did David Cameron used to warn people off being interviewed by you? And
he did actually tell everyone not to be interviewed by us. But
I thought you were mates with Cameron.
Well, we thought so, but actually we realised afterwards that he didn't want any of his cabinet being interviewed
by us.
That's
good. That shows you're doing your job properly. That's great.
Yeah.
I've said, because I interviewed him probably most where Western Morning News, but then later I was at the Mail Online. And he was always quite good when I interviewed at Mail Online, because we do a bit of, like, you know, where it was in the news. He'd been watching beheading videos or something at one point. But then he'd also do a bit of, he was sick of singing the songs from Frozen in the car.
Yeah, I interviewed him once. And the only detail I got, which I thought was illuminating, was we stopped just in the, we're going in the car to a venue, and he stopped to take off his tie. before we got, you know, the car pulled over into a lay-by and he takes his tie off.
Well, he was good at all the things like knits, wasn't he? The fact that his children had knits. He was, and so was Tony Blair. They were both quite good at humanising it to a certain extent. But, I mean, I think difficult political interviews, because quite a lot of the time it's a game. They're trying not to give anything away, and you're trying to get something out of them. And then I think on the other hand, you're trying to find a new story. So you do want to facilitate what they want to say. You don't want to block them the whole time. And you don't want to get a story that they don't actually believe. You want to, you know, you're not a cipher, but at the same time, you're also not trying to be antagonistic. It's quite a complicated routine, really.
Michael Howard was a tricky one, because I think I said it in the Vaughan Gething piece that it's not so much he didn't like him, it's just that he felt he didn't like you.
Did you have to ask him every question 14 times?
No, I didn't. But it's another one where, okay, they don't want to give anything away, but what you mustn't convey to an interviewer is that you don't want to be there. Because that's just bad manners.
Yeah.
And it means that the interviewer is going to go away and think,
really hard work. Yeah. I remember, I think one of the worst I did was when I was at the Western Morning News. And this was like a real, like, last throes of Gordon Brown's premiership. So like late 2009, they invited the regional papers to go to Afghanistan with him, because basically nobody else wanted to go. And my paper was the only one, because it was like the last days of Rome,
yeah,
willing to stump up to send me to Afghanistan.
Hey.
On condition I'd get an interview with Gordon Brown on the way there.
Yeah.
And there was a guy, I've forgotten his name, which is bad, who was a bomb disposal expert. It was from our patch.
Uh-huh.
And he dined.
Ooh.
And his wife had spoken a lot to the papers and that sort of thing. And so I thought, well, I'll talk to him about that and try and sort of humanise the whole point of going. And it was just before Christmas. And all I wanted to get him to do was to say, everyone should like pause and remember people who are away at Christmas.
Yeah.
And those who've, you know, given their lives.
Not too difficult.
Know, not that difficult. And I think he was literally so suspicious of journalists, thinking I was laying some sort of
treating you like an unexploded
trap.
Bomb.
Yeah, I couldn't. I couldn't get him to say.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be nice if everyone on Christmas Day paused and remembered people who were serving abroad or those who have given their lives?
Yes.
And he just couldn't. He just couldn't. He was so tense about the idea of committing it. And in the end, I think we ended up he either did do it later on, or they gave me the quotes written down through a press. You know.
Yeah.
It was a very weird, sort of slightly frustrating, and also incredibly expensive way to get literally nothing.
That's tricky.
They're good on their childhoods, though. I mean, that's why I think now they do talk about their childhoods more, because it's easier. They can talk about difficult times most of them.
Keir Starmer's sort of polished it so much now that it's like a you can't. His dad being a toolmaker and the pebble dash semi and the
and the donkeys
and the flute and the donkeys sort of. We could all do that now. Anyway, it's interesting. It was a great piece, but it was a better piece about you than it was about him.
Yeah.
Right, we're going to add now to the list of things that Crampton doesn't like. We've already got Elton John, picnics, hot weather, cyclists.
I actually mentioned Elton John unfavourably in that piece that we're now going to talk about.
Well, because... so this was your piece...
I put that in entirely for your benefit.
I enjoyed it. You know, I'm glad that we're gradually winning you over.
I don't like the fact that Damon Albarn was at Coachella and he's singing his song from 30 years ago, Girls and Boys.
Yeah.
And the audience is insufficiently participatory in the chorus. And he slags them off.
So I think we've got a little clip. Here he is. So this is Damon Albarn, frontman of Blur, at Coachella, trying to get the audience to sing along. Second set.
I understand his frustration, but it's an absolute tenet of show business that you don't. It's like as I say, it's in a democracy you don't blame the electorate, and in show business you don't blame the audience. Do you?
Well, I don't think so. Let's speak to someone who's played at this fest, because it's got a particular reputation as well, Coachella, as being it's basically where sort of slightly
rich Californians.
They should be singing back. I think
more
you do.
Yeah, I kind of think actually it's sort of vaguely polite about them. They're all a bit middle-aged.
They don't have to.
That's what he's saying, isn't it?
Yeah, they don't have to.
So let's meet Andy Lewis, who played Coachella with Paul Weller's band. Hi, Andy.
Hello.
Are they a particularly tough crowd?
It's hard to say, really. I mean, festivals are a very different gig to doing your own gig. So I think that... you know, for Blur, they've been out in America a little bit. They've been playing some shows in much smaller venues where they've got their own crowd. Mm. And the temptation when you get on stage, wherever you are, is to think that everybody's there to see you. But festival rule number one is that most of the people in a festival don't have a clue who you are, especially if you're playing somewhere in a country where you haven't really broken through. I mean, we had a great time. We came on stage with Paul and we played our show and the audience loved it, but they didn't know who we were. They were going along with it and jumping up and down and having fun. But they all had their phones out and they were all sort of like presumably texting their mates back home and going, look at us, we're having a fabulous time. And we're here and you're not. But that's fine. That's what people do now. You can't expect festival audiences to know who you are. And you certainly can't expect people that don't use pop music as a social medium, but they do use social media as a social medium to get the same level of audience participatory feedback that you might have had when you were playing your own gig the night before.
It's a great point. I hadn't thought about that. That's a superb point, isn't it? They're not there to see Blur.
It's a festival. That's the whole point.
They're
there to have a good time and enjoy themselves. And you know, whether they're enjoying themselves by whooping along with your songs. I mean, a bit later on in the evening, I think the crowd were absolutely fine with people that they kind of knew who they were or were sort of currently popular on the social medium of the day. But it doesn't matter. I mean, if they're enjoying themselves, it's absolutely fine if they don't know the words to the song.
know, but also, it's not their job.
It's not their job.
And also, Andy, it's a cardinal sin, isn't it, to attack the audience in the middle of your show?
I got to say, I mean, the one of the worst moments of my career as a musician was when you could see that we'd completely lost the crowd at a festival. And I won't say where it was or what it was, but it didn't help that it was raining. And you noticed the people at the back of the auditorium drifting away, and there's nothing do. You can't blame them for going off and finding somewhere dry. You just have to keep going, and that's, you know, I don't, that's, you know, it's show business, but I like Blur. I think Damon Albarn's all right. I think it's a minor blip, but it's a perfectly understandable blip when you're sort of fired up in the heat of the moment to sort of like look at an audience, think, well, why am I not getting it back? And it's why, because if the gig doesn't have a roof on and they're not there to see it,
ultimately, Alice, it's fine to think it, but don't say it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think you go back.
Or if you do say it, you say it in the privacy of your dressing room, and you say it among people who will agree with you. Yeah, you don't necessarily say it in the middle of the gig and in a way that throws, I mean, I don't know if you heard all of it, but it threw some of the rest of the people in the band off the crowd a little bit. I mean, they lost the boot a little bit, which is a terrible thing to do. But we've all been there. We've all done things on, well, I have. We've all done things on stage we regret doing. But, you know, unfortunately these days, you do one thing and before you know where you are, it's halfway around the world.
Well, that's the other thing. A few years ago, it was stayed in the privacy of the film.
Yeah, and columnists start writing snarky little articles.
Exactly. All because of social media, which is on your list of things you don't like.
He's not going to want to do it again, though, now, is it? It's going to be really excruciating.
It'll be
on best behaviour.
Just be like, you're the best clown we've ever had.
Massive thanks to Andy Lewis, who played with Paul Weller at Coachella, Alice Thompson and Robert Crandon. Of course, you can read them both in The Times every week with your subscription at thetimes.co.uk. Up next, it's PMQ's Unpacked.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
PMQs Unpacked on Times Radio. Unpacking the politics and cutting through the crossfire.
Order, order. I call Matt Chorley and Tim Shipman.
And Tim Shipman's here. Not seen you for ages.
No, I know, and I'm sorry I clobbered the camera. Well, I was so captivated by your jacket.
If you were watching, as you can do every week, PMQ's Unpacked on the Times Radio YouTube channel, as he arrived in the studio, Tim clobbered himself on the camera. But it's all fine. We're all watching. If you want to watch along, go to the Times Radio YouTube channel. You can see what is occurring. Ross says, I hope the camera is unhurt. No one concerned about your welfare, unfortunately, Tim.
No, I'm all right.
So it's been a month since we were here.
Yes, well, yeah, they've been away.
They've been away on their recesses.
We had some fun doing historic ones.
A lot has
the quality
happened.
Of which was quite good by comparison.
Although we did have, you know, 25 years to pick from. That's, I'm sure, true. There were some duffers in there. Quite a lot has happened, and yet not a lot has happened. Whatever has occurred has not had a huge impact on the...
and the Tories sort of waiting for it. It must narrow, it must narrow, it must narrow. They're still waiting, aren't they? And it's not clear that anything that's happened in the last sort of week that's likely to come up today is going to change any of that. But it should be a lively one. They've not had a go at each other for a while. You've got local elections coming up where they want to score some points. And, you know, there's a bit of good news for Sunak. But you know, the prospect of his predecessor, Liz Truss, rampaging around, giving interviews left, right and centre, and reminding people of what went wrong for the Tories on the economy, may be a helpful opening for the Leader of the Opposition, I suspect.
So Liz Truss was in the Commons yesterday. I'm not sure she's ever made an appearance at PMQs since she... But she barely made an appearance at PMQs when she was Prime Minister, of course. But on the front bench next to Keir Starmer, on one side he's got Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor. On the other side is Angela Rayner, his deputy. So they've both got their own trouble at home, I think.
Indeed. And it'll be interesting to see whether Sunak feels the need to break the glass-marked police investigation into Angela Rayner at some point during proceedings. Doesn't feel like his style, particularly. But we'll see.
We'll wait and see. So we can now go live to the House of Commons then. This is question number one from Keir Starmer.
It's the Leader of the Opposition, Keir Starmer.
Can I too welcome the postmasters in the gallery in their quest for justice? And Mr. Speaker, this week we marked 35 years since the disaster at Hillsborough. And the enduring courage and determination of the families must be marked by the passing of a Hillsborough law. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, we also lost Lord Richard Rosser, a lifelong member of the Labour Party. He will be greatly missed, and our thoughts are with his wife Sheena, his family and friends. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, I'm privileged to be the proud owner of a copy of the former Prime Minister's new book. It's a rare, unsigned copy.
Oh, dear.
It's the only unsigned copy. It's quite the read. She claims the Tory party's disastrous kamikaze budget that triggered chaos for millions was, her words, the happiest moment of her premiership. Has the Prime Minister met anyone with a mortgage who agrees?
Also talked about Liz Truss's
book. Mr. Speaker, all I'd say is he ought to spend a bit less time reading that book and a bit more time reading the Deputy Leader's tax advice.
Wow!
Well, that answers that one then.
Slam dunk. That's more like it.
Yes, I mean, and that's punchy, and also gets to the heart of this issue, which is. In terms of the politics of it, it's partly about what Angela Rayner did or didn't do and whether she misled various tax or electoral authorities. There's this whole question about the legal advice and the fact that Starmer purports to back Rayner, but apparently hasn't read it.
Yeah.
Which he seems to be not doing precisely because he doesn't want to know what's in it.
Yeah.
Because that may or may not support what she's claimed about it.
And for a man who has put quite a lot of store by the fact he's a lawyer, former director of public prosecutions, he's prosecuted more people than you've had hot dinners and so on. Well, not.
I mean, that's not actually
perhaps
true.
Perhaps not you, but other people have had hot dinners. But to then say, "Well, legal advice has nothing to do with me. My team have looked at it." Does seem a little bit odd. An interesting. I mean, of all the things to pick out of the book, what's quite smart about that question from Keir Starmer is it zeroes in on the message they want to land. The kamikaze budget, we've not had that for a long time, but it's the mini budget led to the mortgage increases, Labour says. And so she literally describes in the book, on her way to a visit after the mini budget, describing it as the happiest time of her life.
Yeah, she hadn't realised sort of how badly it had gone wrong at that point,
no.
We should say. But
I'm not sure she still does.
I read it cover to cover last night, actually.
Yeah.
I found it more sort of entertaining and interesting than Patrick did in his review on the Times website now. And she makes a lot of good points, but she doesn't make many good points about herself. There's not a lot of self-reflection there.
In the piece that I wrote, it was zero self-reflection, essentially.
I think that's fair. And it's, yeah, there's plenty there to latch onto. She's right that prime ministers have no support and ought to have medical backup and someone to do their hair without somebody in. All of that's fair enough. She even makes she raises interesting questions about all these public institutions like the OBR and the Bank of England and how accountable they are and all the rest of it. But she then dismisses it all as lefty wokeism, and there's not really a lot of sort of... having identified the problem and drawn it to people's attention, she's not really offering vast numbers of solutions. And there are some, you know, hilarious bits in it.
We don't need to get too bogged down again, but if she mounted a big argument about how we need a more politicised political system.
Well, it's about Parliament. Yeah, is Parliament supreme or isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, with the Supreme Court and lots of these quangos and other public bodies, which are seen as sort of unimpeachable, her view is that they have an opinion and it's contrary to her own. And, you know, there's quite a decent amount of evidence for that. But what is the alternative to the OBR? We had the OBR because in the past, the Treasury used to just make up its own estimates and it was completely nonsensical.
Make up her own numbers. But anyway, let's not get bogged down in Liz Truss again, because I suspect that Keir Starmer will. Let's go back to the House of Commons. PMQ's Unpacked. Question two from Keir Starmer. People very excited about Rishi Sunak's comeback there, about we spend less time reading Liz Truss's book and more time reading Angela Rayner's legal advice. Lindsay Hoyle's on his feet.
And he probably had a flowchart which said, if he goes for Truss, I go for Rayner.
Yeah.
Keir Starmer.
Mr. Speaker, we've got a billionaire Prime Minister and a billionaire Prime Minister, both of whose families have used schemes to avoid millions of pounds of tax, smearing a working class woman. And the Prime Minister, has a long list of people to blame for the economic misery. They don't want to hear it. They made her Prime Minister. And millions of people are paying the price.
I mean, she's got speaking, a long lots of them didn't
list
want
of people to blame. She blames the Governor of the Bank of England, the Treasury, the Office for Budget Responsibility. The American President is blamed at one point. We even learned that the poor old lettuce was part of the deep state. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that it's actually much simpler than that? It was the Tories' unfunded tax cuts, tens of billions of pounds of unfunded tax cut, that crashed the economy and left millions paying more on their mortgages, wasn't it?
Mr. Speaker, everyone knows that 2 years ago I wasn't afraid to repeatedly warn about what her economic policies would lead to, even if it wasn't what people wanted to hear at the time. Mr. Speaker, I was right then, but I'm also right now when I say that his economic policies would be a disaster for Britain. He would send inflation up, mortgages up, and taxes up, and working people would pay the price.
Well, finally, might be tempted to say, after, you know, how long has he been in power now? 15, 18 months. And that's the first time he's properly gone for Liz Truss in public and said, you know, I lost to her, even though I made the argument that she was completely wrong.
I was right.
And here I am, prepared to say it, finally. And frankly, quite a lot of us wonder why he hasn't done it before. For quite some time now. But smart politics from Starmer, you know, going after a working class woman, you're a billionaire. I mean, technically he isn't, and his wife is sort of pushing billionaire status, at least in dollars. but Labour would be the first people to say...
I think if you're arguing about whether or not you're
a billionaire, but Labour would be the first people to say, oh, you shouldn't, you know, equate a wife by her husband or a husband by her wife. It's sort of... I think there's a hint as well, isn't there? In the first question as well, you know, do you know anybody with a mortgage, he said in the first question, who feels the same way? The hint being, you haven't got a mortgage, have you, mate? You don't understand this. And then the billionaire hit in the second question. So it's smart politics, and it's probably not a fight that Sunak is going to be able to win rhetorically, Liz Truss versus Angela Rayner. But interesting that instead of pivoting back to Rayner, he got stuck into Truss. So, you know, it's at best a score draw so far for Sunak, but I think he deserves some credit for both answers, to be honest.
Well, they're smart. I mean, actually, in terms of because the complaint normally is that lots of listeners get in touch, that he doesn't really answer the question. He just reads out the pre-planned lines and they're normally burble, burble, werble, werble, you know, inflation, whatever. These are proper, sharp, political comebacks. Which has sort of levelled the scores a bit. I take your point. It's as far as he's gone in terms of attacking Liz Truss. He still hasn't sort of done it.
It's still
properly.
It's still not with the studs up, is it?
No. Well, maybe he's holding back for for the next outing. Let's go back then. This is question number three from Keir Starmer.
Well, I appreciate the Prime Minister having the stomach to say it out loud, but everyone knows it's the Tory party's obsession with wild, unfunded tax cuts that crashed the economy. We know it, he knows it, they know it, and the whole country is living it. So when is he finally going to learn the lesson from his predecessor's mistakes and explain where the money is coming from for his own completely unfunded £46 billion promise to scrap national insurance?
Mr Speaker, when my predecessor was running for leader, to use his words, I did have the stomach to argue out loud about her economic policies, had the conviction to say that they were wrong. But not once, but twice, he tried to make his predecessor Prime Minister. Despite him opposing NATO and Trident, ignoring anti-Semitism and siding with our enemies. It's clear what he did. He put his own interests ahead of Britain's.
Blimey, this is proper...
Yeah, it's proper. Not just Weetabix, it's with crack cocaine on top, isn't it? By Sunak standards, anyway.
I'm not sure that Liz Truss is necessarily going to survive till the end of question six at this rate, if he keeps on cracking it up. So that the argument that Labour really try to land, and if people have been on social media, you'll have seen these adverts a lot, that the ambition of Jeremy Hunt to abolish national insurance at some point in the future, were you to do that right now, would cost you £46 billion.
Yes.
Which is handily £1 billion more than the £45 billion of unfunded tax cuts that Liz Truss put forward.
Yes, and so decent argument building for Starmer. We sometimes criticise him for not sort of doing this. And, so he's managed to have a sort of populist pop at Truss.
Of the usual length.
Yes, you know, and it's building an argument for something now, and that's, you know, that's good work. But again, a punchy response from Sunak. You know, the argument he wants to draw is that I'm prepared to make difficult decisions and say the unthinkable, and, you know, I'm sure hear about... Starmer, you know, not telling people what he's really about and toading to the unions at some point during this session of answers. But so, I mean, whisper it cautiously. We're only halfway through, but this is the best session for the both of them for quite some time, I would say.
And actually, you know, because some people say it's all, you know, Punch and Judy, knockabout nonsense, all that. What's the point of obsessing so much about PMQs? But they do, at their best, tell us about where the parties are heading. They try out arguments. This is what the general election is going to look like.
Yes.
You're rich, out of touch. You and your lot crash the economy.
Yep.
And Rishi Sunak needs to answer those questions. And actually, turning on Liz Truss for the first time is part of that. And then the counter argument is you can't trust Keir Starmer. He's all over the place. He tried to make Jeremy Corbyn Prime Minister twice.
And he'll say whatever it takes.
He'll say whatever it takes, and he'll probably put your mortgage up in the process. So actually, teasing those out. I mean, more than anything today, that both are much, much shorter.
Yes,
which is just makes for a sharper political exchange.
Yeah, it also gives the other guy less time to think about what he's doing. And it's it's a very good technique. Anyone who's prepped people for PMQs will tell you that they try and encourage some of that, and most of the people doing it.
Best possible
ramble
thing.
On.
Stand up, say no, sit down.
Yeah.
And then, because I don't know what's going on. Oh, well, let's find out then. Let's go back to question number four from Keir Starmer.
I think actually when he was running for Prime Minister, for leader, he was explaining how he's funneling money from poor areas to pay it into richer areas. We know what his record is. I notice he's not denying the £46 billion promise to scrap the national insurance, but is refusing to say where the money will come from. And we've been trying for months to get to the bottom of this. So now's his chance. No more spin, no more waffle, no more diversion. I know that'll be difficult. He can either, Mr Speaker, this is the choice, he can either cut state pension or the NHS that national insurance funds, that's route one, or he can put up income tax. Which one is it?
Prime Minister. Mr Speaker, we've just cut taxes by £900 for a typical worker. We've delivered the biggest tax cut for businesses since the 1980s. But while we're cutting taxes, Labour is already putting them up. In Wales, putting up taxes right now for small businesses. In Birmingham, putting up council tax by 21%. And in London, his mayor has put up taxes by 70%, Mr. Speaker. And this is just a glimpse of what they'd do if they got in power. A few weeks ago, he finally admitted it to The Sun. What would he say he would do? I quote, he said, "We would put up taxes." It's always the same, Mr. Speaker. Higher taxes and working people paying the price.
So there's an interesting question here. When Keir Starmer is trying to attack, you know, do you want to abolish national insurance? That would cost £46 billion. It's Liz Truss all over again. Is he in danger of amplifying a Tory thing about being the people who want to cut your taxes?
I mean, potentially. I mean, it depends to a degree how much the media starts to obsess about black holes in people's spending plans, and that tends to be a feature of general election campaigns. But the strength of Sunak's answer is we're not talking about an abstract thing that might happen. He's then talking about things that are already happening. Yeah. And Labour's problem, you know, in the economic debate is always, even when they turn up, as Brown and Blair did before 97, and as Rachel Reeves and Starmer are now doing, and say, you know, we will be fiscally responsible, you know, the record is that most Labour governments put up taxes and raise unemployment. It kind of happens every time, regardless of, you know, obviously they invest more in public services as well, and that is the trade-off. But both sides always try to pretend that you can have both of what they want.
And actually,
you do have to choose.
In terms of the answer to Keir Starmer's question, what do? Do you cut pensions and national insurance, which actually aren't funded by hypothecation of national insurance as a sort of myth? But anyway, or do you put up income tax? And isn't the truth that the idea is you would basically move it onto income tax? I mean, it's just the point is you would only be taxing income on one figure rather than two.
Yeah, exactly. That's quite a complicated argument to make in a short time. And this is why Labour, if Sunak had said his plan was to abolish income tax, I don't think Labour would be getting quite so uppity about it. They know that people sort of like the idea of national insurance because it sounds like it's to do with the NHS and the state pension, which is kind of what it was originally for. It's just another income tax, and it's slightly pernicious one because it just kind of happens and you know, it disappears from your pay packet. You don't really know what the combined rate is and all the rest of it. And people who want sort of tax transparency have been all in favour of effectively merging the two for years. It's politically difficult for precisely the reasons we're seeing now because, you know, Labour will turn around, and we've seen this in focus groups and some polling, that, you know, people hear national insurance to be cut and they think, you know, the NHS is going to be cut, the pension's going to be cut. So there's a fundamental misunderstanding in the public at large about this, and Labour are taking advantage of that.
Lots and lots and lots of comments on the YouTube channel. Sarah says, what makes Sunak think he's any good at being PM? Is it just arrogance and entitlement? Hugo says Sunak is flopping about. This might play well with Sunak's backbenchers, says Dave, but it just sounds off to the public. Taxes at a record high, says John. And then others saying that he's, you know, he's had his Weetabix and he's up and at him. And it's good to see, in trying to paint, Hugo says Sunak is very far from Truss, and trying to make that distinction. Somebody else says Labour's £28 billion unfunded Green New Deal, although I think that's been quietly parked. It's Matt Chorley on Times Radio with Tim Shipman, Sunday Times chief political commentator, bringing you PMQs and Pat on Times Radio. Let's go back to the House of Commons now. This is question number four from Keir Starmer.
No single politician has ever put tax up more times than he has.
Question five.
But Mr. Speaker, just hang on, because he was given the chance. He was just given the chance to rule out cutting the NHS or state pensions to pay for scrapping this. I was a lawyer long enough to know when someone's avoiding the question. So I'm going to give him another chance. Will he now rule out cuts the NHS, cuts the state pension, or putting up taxes to pay for his unfunded £46 billion promise to scrap national insurance? Which is it?
Mr. Speaker, I make absolutely no apology about wanting to end the unfairness of the double taxation on work, Mr. Speaker. The NHS is receiving record funding under this Conservative government. Pensioners have just received a £900 increase under this government. But if he wants to talk about tax, let's have a look at what Labour's brand newly appointed tax advisor has to say. This advisor thinks that supporting pensioners is a complete disgrace, Mr. Speaker. He believes their free TV licences are ridiculous. And if it wasn't bad enough, this advisor has called for increases in income tax, in national insurance and VAT. Yeah, it all makes sense now. That's who the Shadow Chancellor's been copying and pasting from.
Well, that's an old joke about that's Rachel Reeves in her book, where large parts of it seem to have been lifted from Wikipedia. That Edward Troop, Sir Edward Troop, if you don't mind. Excuse me. He is now advising. He's a new tax czar for the Labour Party. He previously said that codger pensioners have had it ridiculously good. According to a story in The Express last week. He warned today's pensioners had it ridiculously good. It was a complete disgrace that pensioners aren't paying national insurance. We're going to have to look at more senior members of society. And what The Express described as a final insulting blow, Ms. Reeves' new right-hand man described older voters as codgers. He said, I'm told I can't use the word codgers, but as I'm officially a codger, I think I will. Anyway, there we are, codgers all round. I'm wondering now about the wisdom of the Starmer attack, if it's just a letting Rishi Sunak talk about cutting taxes again. Don't people ultimately like having tax cuts?
I mean, I think generally they do, though a lot of the polling at the moment shows it's not the priority for people. They're more concerned about public investment. So it's not as propitious a sort of environment for Sunak as it might have been. And I think there's kind of a sense that Tory backbenchers obsess about tax cuts, but the public just wants things to function and for it to be sort of broadly fair that, you know, people across the income scale are paying for it. Yes, everybody wants to open their pay pack and see a bit more money each month. But the problem the Tories have got is that, you know, most people are still, regardless of, you know, the extra 900 quid they've just got, feeling less well off than they were 4 or 5 years ago. And clearly the pandemic and oil prices as a result of Ukraine have contributed hugely to that. But again, that's not much of an argument when you're into sort of Punch and Judy politics.
It was interesting as well, and we've talked about this previously on the show, that people's perceptions of how well the economy is doing is also, particularly in American policy as well, quite closely linked to whose side you're on. So you could be, right now, you'd be a Republican saying the economy was doing very badly, and the moment your guy wins,
suddenly
you think you've decided the economy is doing well. So the very fact that the Conservatives are polling so badly and Rishi Sunak's personal ratings are so low, people project onto that the economy is doing badly and I'm feeling very badly off.
And they're predisposed to not then give him the credit if it turns
exactly,
as well.
Because they've already decided
that
it's a bad environment overall, and then that sort of infiltrates everything. And then if you are a Labour supporter and your guy comes in, then you suddenly decide everything's much better and you realise, oh, I've got a bit of money in my pocket, and you start ascribing that to them. Which is, you know, a lot of that has to do with psychology rather than politics or economics. Let's go back then. This is the final question of PMQ's Unpacked. Question number 6 from Keir Starmer.
So this is genuinely extraordinary. Two chances to rule out, Mr. Speaker, two chances to rule out cuts to state pension, cuts to the NHS, or income tax rises to fund his promise to abolish national insurance.
Order. Mr. Hall.
Dear Lindsay Hall's interrupted.
I want you to set a good
clip.
Example, not a bad one. Keir Starmer.
Telling off Tory.
Mr. Speaker, this really matters. He's had two chances to rule out these cuts to NHS, cuts to tax or pensions or tax rises.
Oh,
this
dear,
matters to millions
pickle.
Of people watching who want to know what's going to happen to their NHS and pensions. It really does matter to millions of people who are watching. So I'll be really generous now and give him one last chance. Very simple, very clear. Is his £46 billion promise to abolish national insurance being paid for by cuts to the NHS, cuts to the state pension, or yet another Tory tax rise?
Mr. Speaker, he's really got to keep up, Mr. Speaker, right? It's this government that's just delivered a £900 increase to the state pension. It's this government that's already committed to the triple lock for the next parliament. He had six opportunities. I didn't think I heard him say that, Mr. Speaker. And when it comes to the NHS, you'd much rather be treated in Conservative-run NHS in England, not the Labour-run NHS in Wales, Mr. Speaker. But it's another week where all we heard is political sniping, Mr. Speaker, not a word about their plans for the country. He's failed to acknowledge that since we last met, taxes have been cut by £900, state pension's gone up, free childcare has been expanded, wages have risen for 9 months in a row, Mr. Speaker, and just today, inflation down again to 3.2%. Our plan is working and the Conservatives are delivering a brighter future for Britain.
Wow. Now, I meant to mention this before. In question five, Keir Starmer really fluffed the question. If he was trying to get the clips for the social media, you know, we asked the Prime Minister three times,
yes,
are you going to cut the NHS? Are you going to cut pensions? Are you going to put up income tax? He got into a right. He sort of fluffed it. He mispronounced some words. He didn't finish the end of the sentence. Well, it was fine because he's going to nail it in question six. And he's
then
Lindsay Hoyle
screwed him up.
Pops in and ruins it.
And then he lost his thread and made a botch of it again.
And then couldn't remember what the thing was again. Now, somebody's just said on the YouTube channel, this is a messy affair. He's wasted the last three questions. Tom said that. I'm not sure that's right. There's quite a...
No, and there's an
effective attack to say, three times I've asked, three times he's not answered. But you need to ask it properly.
Exactly. And going back to what I was saying before, Starmer knows that national insurance is not hypothecated to the NHS and pensions. What he's trying to do is, through Sunak's inaction, attach those two things legitimately together in a way that will satisfy a cynic like me, as well as people who misunderstand how national insurance works. So in that sense, it was a right kind of plan. He didn't quite deliver it as well as he might have done. But again, a pretty bravura comeback from Sunak. Who's acquired himself a slogan as well, a brighter future for Britain. I mean, this criticism of him is that he hasn't really been able to spell out what another 5 years of Rishi Sunak looks like. And if he doesn't do that, he's going to get absolutely obliterated at the election. But, we talk about the green shoots of recovery with inflation and all the rest of it. Some green shoots of political kind of at least understanding what he's got to argue and what he's got to go about doing from Sunak today. I think they'll be pretty pleased with that in number 10.
Easily Rishi Sunak's best performance of PMQs.
I would say, yeah, I mean, I couldn't say overall, but certainly in as long as I can remember. And let's be frank, in a period when he has been in a state of political collapse, where all the word from inside the operation is that they're all sitting around, they're now convinced that not just going to lose, but going to get absolutely mullered. They've lost their mojo. There's infighting going on. Senior people being ignored. The wrong people being listened to, if you'd listen to the MPs. And a sense that this bloke was moping about and didn't really have any clue at all how to try and turn his situation around. Well, I don't think that that's going to end up making the difference. But he showed some fight. He had an argument. And I think the MPs behind him, that won't have done him any harm in terms of seeing off whatever might be coming after the local elections.
I think the...
Showed a bit of fight.
The Labour Party, having thought they'd come up with some clever, clever doings, might be disappointed that he didn't wander straight into the trap.
Yeah, I think that's right. They might have hoped he was sort of... as inept as usual.
Exactly, that's what I mean. So there's no way you can get around this.
And Starmer was a bit sort of taken aback to be not winning easily, I think. In terms of expectation, it was a sort of Sunak victory, really.
And I'm in two minds about Labour pushing on the... I think it's fine to attack the, you know, doing Liz Truss off, you know, outside the chamber, but the risk of doing it in the Commons is that he does actually distance himself from Liz Truss. And then he might get some political credit for it. Then you can't keep... What they actually want to do is keep up the fact that he's never really turned on her. You don't actually want him to turn on Liz Truss.
No, you want to nail the two of them together say that they're guilty of the same things.
So best not to ask him too much about it. Now, Lower Spirits joined us.
Hello.
Yeah, you're on the radio. how was the best of the rest?
They were good, yeah. I don't know what you thought about the vibe in the chamber today, but I thought it was a lot
more lively.
It was much more lively than usual. They've had a good break and a good rest.
And probably a drink.
Maybe a drink. But you know, feisty, you know, proper political, you know, attacks from both Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer.
And certainly, I think, the early signs of what some of the election slogans and campaigning will focus on from Rishi Sunak, there was quite a lot of mention of Birmingham and Wales and London, these kind of Labour-run areas in part where he feels there have been conspicuous failures. There was the plea to vote Susan Hall in the London mayoral election, safer with Susan, uttered from Rishi Sunak's lips.
Good luck with that one.
But there were some very interesting questions. The first of those that we'll go to is from George Galloway, who, of course, won in the Rochdale by-election after...
Who has to be able to see what he does here. Hasn't it necessarily set the Commons alight in the way that breathless profiles suggested he might?
It's true. There was a lot of speculation when he was elected in that by-election that he would be a massive headache for Keir Starmer, that he would be exploiting Labour divisions on the situation in Gaza. And I think it's fair to say that, as of yet, he hasn't caused real difficulty for Keir Starmer. This question is asking after Rishi Sunak's call with Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, and have a listen to it now.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister told us on Monday that he was off to make a telephone call to Mr. Netanyahu to urge restraint on a government that has killed and maimed well over 100,000 people in 6 months, 72% of them women and children. Can he tell us how the telephone call went and what he will do if his advice is not taken and an unrestrained war begins?
Mr. Speaker, I was pleased to speak with Prime Minister Netanyahu, who thanked the UK for their support of Israel's security over the weekend. We also discussed the situation and how Iran is isolated on the world stage. And also I made the point to him that significant escalation is not in anyone's interest, and it's a time for calm heads to prevail. I also reiterated our concerns about the humanitarian situation in Gaza, where I welcome the statements and commitments that the Israeli government have made about significantly increasing aid into Gaza. And now we need to see those commitments delivered.
It's all quite a polite, calm response to, you know, the idea, don't you wind George Galloway up because it might make the situation more difficult. There was this interesting question of why Rishi Sunak said on Monday he was going to speak to Benjamin Netanyahu, and it took another full 24 hours before it actually happened, which I suppose is a side point.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's taken slightly longer, but of course we also have Lord Cameron, who the Times revealed has set off on his trip to Israel, where he will also be visiting. So I think there's a lot of diplomatic action going on that front this week.
Very good. Who else have we got? So, you were teasing us earlier with the fact that two people who've called for Rishi Sunak to go were going to ask questions. Were they any good?
One of them was. One of them was from Dame Andrea Jenkins, who we're going to play last, but perhaps we can play now, who is one of those two MPs who has openly called for Rishi Sunak to go. Of course, it's not difficult, as all of us will have done, to speak to MPs who privately will say that wouldn't be the worst thing.
Very prominently at the Liz Truss book launch last night, Andrea was.
Oh, was she?
Along with half of the Reform Party.
With Farage there?
No, I think he's in Brussels, isn't he? But Richard Tice was.
Oh, of course.
Lee Anderson was.
I don't know why, but I know people. A lot of people complain about the post, but my invite to Liz Truss's book launch still hasn't arrived.
Well, fortunately, you can come to mine next week.
Well, we look forward to that. How have we got so far to PMQs without mentioning your imminent book release?
Well, it's next week.
It's next week. The book is it out next week?
It's out next Thursday.
And you can read details of it?
Well, I'm writing a piece for the Sunday Times this weekend.
Very good.
Which will cover some of what's in it. And the big sort of picture... Me and Brexit, the last 7 years of toil.
Very good. And there'll be a special... Tim will be on the show again on Monday, talking about all of that. Anyway, sorry, Lara, we got... Somehow, we went from Andrew Jenkins talking about Tim.
No, that's okay. Andrew Jenkins is asking about the inquiry into Angela Rayner, the Deputy Labour leader, the police inquiry. And it's interesting because I think we're hearing from Rishi Sunak what his chosen attack line on this saga is.
Name Andrea Jenkins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I abhor a two-tier policing system, and we must ensure that everyone's treated equally under the rule of law. The Labour Police and Crime Commissioner who investigated the Beagate scandal handed their police chief constable a new 3-year contract whilst the investigation into the Labour Party leader and deputy leader was ongoing. Now, two former Labour MPs are overseeing the force due to investigate the opposition deputy leader. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that complete transparency throughout this investigation is of the utmost importance?
My honourable friend makes an important point. A key principle of our country is that there are the same rules for everyone. And when it comes to this topic, I do think the Labour leader should show some leadership. Avoid stop reading the legal advice, simply just publish it and get a grip of the situation. And it says a lot about his priorities, that when it comes to his famed legal expertise, he's more than happy to help defend Hizbut Tahrir, but refuses to help his own deputy leader.
I mean, there was a better response from Keir Starmer. The question was impenetrable, wasn't it?
It was slightly labyrinthine.
Also,
Andrea Jenkins trying to be helpful, but sort of not quite succeeding because no one really knew what she was on about.
Is she the Right Honourable? I'm not sure she is. Is she?
It's possible she was tossed one by Boris Johnson. I imagine
Privy Council,
along with the damehood.
I don't think she was.
I don't think you get.
Not according to Parliament TV, we're hearing. Yeah. Mm. Anyway.
It's a sign of things to come.
Her brief period. What was she briefly? Was she Education Secretary or something for 5 minutes? What job did she have when she flicked the V's? Anyway, let's not get too much.
I'll look it up.
Yeah, thanks so much for that. Interesting, Lara, the way that she said, managed to try to steer it back at least into the land of speaking English.
Yeah, it was slightly risky territory asking him to, in some way, criticise an active police investigation that many of them are quite happy is taking place at all now after objections from a Conservative MP. So I think difficult to manage that one slightly. But as you say, the line there was quite clear that he is, I think many of them going on this fact that Keir Starmer quite perplexingly has said, despite his legal background, that he hasn't seen the legal advice and doesn't need to, despite his team having seen it. I think that's one of the ways that they are going to try and attach this scandal that obviously is troubling Angela Rayner to Keir Starmer as closely as they possibly can, regardless of the outcome.
And actually, I mean, he even brandished his legal background during PMQs today.
He loves doing that.
I was a lawyer long enough to know when someone isn't answering the question, which is interesting. Also, a slightly odd question to basically stand up and say, wouldn't you agree with me that it'd be terrible if there was any political interference and pressure put upon the police? And would you do everything you possibly can to put pressure upon the police to ensure they carry on doing that?
Dame Andrea Jenkins was Parliamentary Undersecretary of State for Skills for 18 days. So you're right, she was in the Department for Education.
Well, she's not.
But she was not a Secretary of State.
Well, I'm glad we've corrected that record. That's what we're here for. She's not Right Honourable. Anyone else?
We've got Daniel Zeichner, who is a Labour MP, with a question about Liz Truss, which we can finish on.
Daniel Zeichner.
In the exchanges earlier, we didn't hear much of a defence from the Prime Minister of his predecessor, so perhaps he could tell the House, what does he consider to be her greatest achievement?
Mr. Speaker, while the party opposite were busy trying to take us back into the EU and reverse the referendum result, my predecessor was signing trade deals around the world, which have now meant, Mr. Speaker, that Brexit Britain has overtaken the Netherlands, France and Japan to become the fourth largest exporter in the world.
Well, that's actually a surprisingly good answer.
I was about to say it was good to see someone reviving the honourable tradition of slightly eccentric Labour MP asking smart-ass questions towards the end of
my favourite was always the guy who asked Tony Blair to sum up his political philosophy, which left him gaping, gape-mouthed like a fish.
Wasn't it his last PMQs? And didn't he just say, I think I'll leave that or something? Yeah. Basically, I can't be bothered.
Yeah.
Yeah. But actually quite a good answer.
Quite a good answer.
Slightly flying in the face of the previous new strategy of criticising Liz Truss.
Which was very interesting, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Which follows what Daniel Finkelstein has written before he should have long done, which is to mark himself out as different from his predecessors.
Well, maybe he's been listening to How to Win an Election.
Perhaps. I'm sure he
has.
Who
isn't?
Well, who isn't? We know that Jeremy Hunt does, because he ended up taking the mick out of Keir Starmer for being fat. Thanks to Peter Manasseh, which we don't need to revive now. Lara, thanks so much for that. So you're going to be in people's inboxes 3 o'clock?
3 o'clock.
Times subscribers, go to thetimes.co.uk/redbox and you get the PMQ's Unpacked inbox in your inbox around four-ish. Tim Shipman.
It's nearer 20 past.
I just looked at Tim as if to say that's so generous of Matt not to mention the time.
Tim Shipman will be in your Sunday Times with a big read on his brand new book, which is called...
No Way Out.
No Way Out. And Tim will be back on the show on Monday discussing all of that, the extraordinary events and non-events of the Theresa May Brexit years, which I've been reliving by reading Tim's book.
Well, I had to live it for twice as long as she did, so I don't see
what it is. And that's what we've got time for. PMQ's Unpacked returns next week, of course, with Patrick and Lara. You can get Lara in your inbox with your subscription at thetimes.co.uk/redbox with her special PMQ's Unpacked email, completing the multimedia experience. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com